At the end of our last program, we mentioned that the Federal Reserve System was passed on December 23, 1913, but one of its most vocal critics was Senator Charles Lindbergh, father of the Lone Eagle. We're going to begin this program with some of Lindbergh's critical statements. Lindbergh once said that it violates every principle of popular democratic representative government and every declaration of the Democratic Party and platform pledges from Thomas Jefferson down to the beginning of this Congress. It recognizes the superior sovereignty of the embodied institution of money over any power of the government, so that neither the government in its sovereign capacity, nor the people or their representatives, can initiate the placement of $1 of monetary functionary into actual exchange among the people, except through the agency of organized monetary loaners with purely selfish interest. The Federal Reserve Act absolutely abolishes the United States Treasury and public money of the people and substitutes the so-called Federal Reserve Bank, which by the term of the bill are to be the exclusive stock of the bankers. It reduces the People's Treasury Department and the Bureau of Printing and Engraving to the position of a job printing house for the private use of the bankers. Well, that's the end of that quote, but think about it. About the only thing our Treasury Department does is print currency for the Federal Reserve Banks. This currency is also generating interest 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, including all holidays. The Federal Reserve actually runs the Treasury Department's Bureau of Printing and Engraving. Lindbergh also said on another time, quote, "This act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the President signs this bill, the invisible government, by the monetary power, will be legalized. The worst legislative crime of the ages is perpetrated by this banking and currency bill. The caucus and the party bosses have again operated and prevented the people from getting the benefits of their own government. The government prosecutes other trusts, but supports the money trust. I have been waiting patiently for several years for an opportunity to expose the false money standard and to show that the greatest of all favoritism is that extended by the government to the money trust." Unquote. Besides Congressman Lindbergh, Senator La Follette let his opinions be known also. He said that a money trust of 50 men controlled the nation. Later, some reporters asked John F. Baker, a partner of J.P. Morgan, if this was true. Mr. Baker said it was not true and that he knew personally that not more than 8 men ran the country. Almost half of the shares of the Federal Reserve stock were owned by the First National Bank, the National City Bank, the National Bank of Commerce, the Chase National Bank, and Hanover National Bank. All these banks were under the control of J.P. Morgan and the Kuhn-Leib Alliance. President Wilson was persuaded to appoint Paul Warburg to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. This distrust of the banking industry didn't just begin with the establishment of the Federal Reserve System, as witnessed from the following statement from Peter Cooper to President Grant back in 1877. He said, "The bankers will favor a course of special legislation to increase their power. They will never cease to ask for more, so long as there is more that can be wrung from the toiling masses of the American people." The author Colco wrote that Woodrow Wilson, a professor of political economy, whom the kingmakers whisked from his ivory tower at Princeton into the presidency in 1912, was trained at Johns Hopkins University in classical, laissez-faire, and the political wiggery of Burke. Wilson was famous for saying, "I'm for big business and I'm against the trust. but he could never define the difference between the two. College professors like Wilson, with overinflated egos, were easy prey for the Oriental traders and stock manipulators who ran rings around these sluggard professors and foisted the Federal Reserve System onto the American people. Here are a couple of books that will be helpful if you want more information on this subject. One is A Monetary History of the United States from 1867 to 1960 by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz. The other is This Difficult Individual by Eustace Mullins. This Difficult Individual was Ezra Pound. It's a scary book that gives the reader the warnings as to how oppressive our government can be. I've told you about another book Eustace Mullins wrote in a previous program. That book was called The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. Now, just to help you understand a little better what was going on at this time, there were two different bills being advocated at the beginning of the 20th century. One was the Aldrich Bill, and the other was the Glass-Owens Bill. Both were considered by the public as being the so-called money reform bills. Colonel Eli Garrison had been one of Theodore Roosevelt's rough riders and a friend and financial advisor to President Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. The Aldrich Bill was rewritten as the Glass-Owens Bill. Eli Garrison maintained that Willis and Glass really rewrote a bill that he and Professor William A. Scott of the University of Wisconsin had written and given to Wilson. Two members of the Glass Banking Committee, Robert L. Henry and Joe H. Engel, both attacked the Glass-Owens Bill as being virtually identical to the Aldrich Bill. Garrison did place great emphasis on his favorite proviso of the proposed legislation, that loans be based on the short-term commercial paper connected with new production, not on government bonds or brokers' loans. This was the real bills doctrine. It was argued that as new money creation brought new goods into existence, it would not be inflationary. There was another professor, Lawrence Laughlin, and he thought that he was the author of the Glass-Owens Bill, but Garrison said that the bankers controlled him. Even Paul Warburg said that Laughlin was decidedly muddle-headed and easy to lead by the nose. Wilson himself could do little toward getting Congress to pass the Federal Reserve Act. In an ironic twist, it was William Jennings Bryan, the Democratic whip, that was the man to get the Federal Reserve Act passed. This was the same man that had been attacking the banking industry in the latter part of the 19th century. The same man that famously said at the Democratic Convention of 1896, quote, "If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard as a good thing, we will fight them to the uttermost, having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interest, the laboring interest, and the toilers everywhere. We will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you will not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." Bryan then stood before the hall with his arms outstretched as a cross, his head tilted to the side toward his shoulder, and for a long moment there was a stunned silence and then an uproar as he was nominated to be the Democratic candidate for the presidency. It was one of the great moments in American political history. I got that speech from the book The Lost Science of Money by Stephen Zarlenga. Once again, I must tell you to go to the website, American Monetary Institute, because he was instrumental in getting the Federal Reserve Act passed. Bryan was awarded by being made Secretary of State. This act, the Federal Reserve Act, was to provide the establishment of Federal Reserve banks to furnish an elastic currency to afford a means of rediscounting commercial paper, to establish more effective supervision of banking in the United States, and for other purposes. Later observers would assert that the real reason for the act was indeed for other purposes. The Federal Reserve System of 1913 and the Bank of England of 1694 have striking similarities. The passing of the legislation for both institutions were secret. Using the words bank or corporation in both instances were avoided, even though both were banks and corporations. Both banks depended heavily on wealthy and more sophisticated foreign supporters and organizers. The Bank of England relied on Dutch and Jewish financiers, and the formula for the Federal Reserve System came largely from Kuhn Lieb bankers connected with the European Rothschild interest. Both banks were very complex and not understood. This was true even within the Federal Reserve itself. Almost no one besides Paul Warburg and Benjamin Strong had a clue as to what would happen. Both institutions were privately owned, but made to appear as government bodies. Both had important early supporters who would later condemn both institutions. In the case of the Bank of England, William Paterson published a book condemning the bank's buildup of the national debt. In the case of the Federal Reserve System, William Jennings Bryan later in life had this to say, quote, "In my long political career, the one thing I genuinely regret is my part in getting the banking and currency legislation enacted into law." Professor H. Parker Willis, who thought he wrote the Federal Reserve Act, attacked it when he saw the extensive foreign influence on it. The Federal Reserve Act originally did have some restrictions which appeared to block arbitrary abuses by the bankers. All printed Federal Reserve notes were to be 100% backed by gold. The governors of the Federal Reserve Board in Washington were appointed by the president. Both the Secretary of the Treasury and the Comptroller of the Currency were members of the board. The real bills doctrine, which meant all commercial loans created as a deposit in a bank, were to be backed 100% by commercial obligations based on new production plus an additional 14% by gold. Benjamin Strong, the first chairman of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, wrote to Paul Warburg on November 1, 1913, and in the letter he questioned the provision in the Federal Reserve Act that the note issues are to bear the obligation of the United States government. This, he said, is a provisional return to the heresies of greenbackism and fiat money. But over time, the bankers used their power to remove some restrictions that they had originally agreed on. For instance, by June 1917, the 100% gold backing on the printed notes were reduced to 40% gold and 60% acceptable commercial paper. This would be a good time to give a little familiarity on the background of some of the people involved with our country at this period of time. For instance, Senator John Sherman, who authored the Sherman Antitrust Act, which was the act that made trust more powerful, was a senator from Ohio. He was the brother of William Tecumseh Sherman, who, under Lincoln's direct orders, makes 20th century war criminals appear benign in comparison. Sherman's army raped, pillaged, and thieved their way from Atlanta to Richmond, burning, destroying, raping black as well as white women, and stealing everything that was not tied down. They destroyed all seed stock to ensure that Southerners would starve. They burned every farm and every plantation they came in contact with. Well, Paul Warburg was a recent immigrant from Germany. He came from the international banking house of M.M. Warburg of Germany. This banking house was closely associated with the Rothschilds. He joined the banking firm of Kuhn Lieb & Company, making $500,000 a year, giving talks on money reform. And he couldn't speak English very well. The Warburgs reached their outstanding eminence during the 19th century, simultaneously with the growth of Kuhn Lieb Company of New York, with whom they stood in a personal union and family relationship. Paul Warburg, with magnificent success, carried through in 1913 the reorganization of the American banking system at which he had, with Senator Aldrich, been working since 1911, and thus most thoroughly consolidated the currency and finances of the United States. The Kuhn Lieb Bank was started by Abraham Kuhn and Solomon Lieb, who were general merchandise merchants in Lafayette, Indiana, in 1850. As usual, in newly settled regions, most transactions were made on credit, and they soon found that they were bankers. Gradually forgetting about merchandise, they moved east. In Cincinnati, Ohio, they got considerable help from the Civil War. In 1867, they established Kuhn Lieb Company, bankers in New York City, and took in a young German immigrant by the name of Jacob Schiff as a partner. Young Schiff had important financial connections in Europe. After 10 years, Jacob Schiff was head of Kuhn Lieb, Kuhn having died and Lieb retired. Under Schiff's guidance, the house brought European capital into contact with American industry, which was then badly in need of it. The Union Pacific had used up a lot of funds, and the railroad failed to earn a return. The panic of 1893 added the finishing touch. That failure was a boon to Kuhn Lieb. By financing E.H. Harriman's plans for a new Union Pacific Railroad, the firm set itself up as the chief financial backers of American railways. Jacob Schiff had descended from the Schiff family that had shared a home with Amschel Mayer Rothschild called Greenshield, which was mentioned in an earlier program. Jacob Schiff's important financial connections in Europe were with the Rothschild brothers and their principal German agents, the Warburg family. From 1905 on, when the first communist revolution in Russia failed and the Jews had to scramble out of Russia, they all went to Germany, and Germany gave them refuge. The Jews were very involved in the first Russian revolution, which failed. It was Jacob Schiff who financed the Japanese war against Russia, and it was the same banker that financed the revolution among the Russian war prisoners in Japan. It was the first major war of the 20th century. On February 15, 1911, Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Lieb & Company, while in the White House, refused to shake hands with President William Howard Taft because the president had refused to abrogate the U.S. Tsarist-Russian Commercial Treaty of 1832 so that the German international banking houses could handle the trading. Schiff stormed out of the White House saying, "This means war." 3 years later, the Kaiser turned loose his military machine. Other than Grover Cleveland, Woodrow Wilson was the only Democratic president elected to office since the Civil War. Historian James Perloff tells us that Bernard Baruch brought Wilson to the Democratic Party headquarters in New York in 1912, leading him like one would a poodle on a string. Wilson received an indoctrination course from the leaders convened there. Congressman Lewis T. McFadden said that the Aldrich bill was condemned in the platform when Woodrow Wilson was nominated. The men who ruled the Democratic Party promised the people that if they were returned to power, there would be no central bank established here while they held the reins of government. 13 months later, that promise was broken, and the Wilson administration, under the tutelage of those sinister Wall Street figures who stood behind Colonel House, established here in our free country the worm-eaten, monarchical institution of the King's Bank to control us from the top downward and to shackle us from the cradle to the grave. Unquote. We'll give you a little more insight into Colonel Mandel House on a later program. Now, here's a little more background on John D. Rockefeller, which you may or may not know. And we start this with James Stillman. James Stillman became head of Citibank in 1891. This was the main financier of the United States in the Spanish-American War. Stillman was a good friend of William Rockefeller, the younger brother of John D. Rockefeller, and Stillman had two daughters who married two of the sons of William Rockefeller. So the William Rockefellers wound up owning Citibank. William told John that banking was a good business, so John D. Rockefeller bought the banking house called Equitable Trust, which they expanded and absorbed other banks throughout the decades of the 20s, and it eventually bought out the Chase Bank. When a banking scandal emerged, Wiggin, the president of Chase Bank, became the scapegoat and was forced to retire in disgrace without a pension. John D.'s son married the daughter of Senator Nelson Aldrich. Winthrop Aldrich, Senator Aldrich's son, became a powerful vice president of Chase. I'm sure you all know that David Rockefeller, grandson of John D. Rockefeller, was for years the chairman of the Chase Bank, once called the Chase Manhattan Bank. Now we're going to shift gears here and give you an example of how banks have worked in the past, which should give you an idea as to how banks are now working and, in my opinion, should not work. The banking firm of J&W Seligman was instrumental in building the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal was first attempted by the French. Their backers were J&W Seligman and J.P. Morgan. These two banking houses sold shares of stock in the project all over the world. What made the Panama Canal attractive to investors was its world-famous French engineer Ferdinand de Lesseps, who had successfully built the Suez Canal, which was completed in 1869. At the same time the French were attempting to build the canal across Panama, investors in the United States were considering the construction of a canal across Nicaragua. Many engineers still say the best route for the canal would have been across Costa Rica and Nicaragua because of a series of lakes and rivers which provided a partial waterway. That theory is unimportant now because both projects collapsed. The first project to fail was the Costa Rica-Nicaragua canal due to undercapitalization. But after 9 years, the Panama Canal was only one-third completed. A total of $100 million had been spent, almost four times the original estimate, to complete the entire job. The Seligman Bank had invested much of its own funds in building a railroad which had only partially completed terminals. After both canals failed, Congress decided to make it a United States project. Studies were begun to determine once and for all the best route from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. In order to protect their investment, the Seligmans hired a French public relations man by the name of Felipe Buneau Varilla. This may have been the earliest use of a, quote, public relations man in business. He came to this country to sell the route across the Isthmus of Panama. He did this by convincing Congress that Nicaragua had volcanoes which might prove dangerous, either to the construction or to the finished project. He must have had quite a lot of charisma, because Congress and the Senate did pass a resolution selecting Panama as the best route. But then another problem popped up for the Seligman Bank. At that time, Panama was not an independent nation. It was a province of Colombia, and Colombia refused to grant the United States the right-of-way. Varela told the Seligman Bank that the only way out of this predicament was a revolution and have Panama secede from Colombia. Panama had tried to break away from Colombia in 1830, 1831, and 1840. Between 1850 and 1902, Panama staged over 50 uprisings against Colombia, so a revolution did not sound so outlandish. The problem posed to Varela by the Seligman Bank was, how much would a revolution cost? Their public relations man would have to find out. So he took off for Central America. A few months later, he returned with the answer. $6 million was the price for the revolution. No way, the bankers said. If there's going to be a revolution, it would have to be a cut-rate revolution. They would go $100,000 and no more. Now, this was a pretty big assignment for a French public relations man. Having a cut-rate revolution. But he was up to the task, and he must have been an extremely good salesman, because he wrangled an interview with Theodore Roosevelt and asked, if hostilities break out between Colombia and Panama, will the American warships be sent to protect American lives and interest? The American interest, of course, were the Seligman interest, and the warship Nashville was sent to Panama to oversee the crisis. It evidently intimidated the Colombians because Panama gained her independence in 1903. J.N.W. Seligman was instrumental in financing many revolutions in Latin America, but its most notorious publicity came in 1933. During a Senate Finance Committee investigation of the Seligman firm, it was brought out that it had given a $415,000 bribe to Juan Leguia, son of the president of Peru, in order to get that nation to accept a loan. Well, that's all we have time for today. Please join me next time, and we'll talk more about the Federal Reserve. Have a good week.